guide me. That saved a wretch like me.
Thank you, Reuben. Appreciate it very much. What a great way to start services this morning. Appreciate everyone being here. It's a great day. It's an absolutely wonderful day at Country Club Road Church of Christ. It's always a great day to be here, but today is especially great. We're celebrating the anniversary of Doug and Nikki for 20 years and Jonah for 17 or 18. We're just so excited about today. We have a fellowship to follow. If you haven't brought any food for this fellowship, don't worry about it. We're going to have plenty for everybody. We'd like for everybody to stay, or if you'd like to go buy some chicken a little bit later on, we'd appreciate that as well. Thank you again for being here. Gosh, we've got some Sharon Johnsons here. Glad to see you, Sharon. We'd like to have a record of your attendance. If you could fill out a card in front of you and send it down to the end of the aisle, we have some fine young men who will pick those up at the proper time. Special greeting to our guests. Thank you, one and all, for being with us. Sympathy to Charlotte and Mary Kay on the passing of their mom, Sue Spear. Services were held yesterday in Artesia. Special prayer request this morning for Darius Mendoza, who is undergoing chemotherapy right now in Denver. George Escalante, who will be having a heart procedure done this week. And Larry Williams will also undergo a wrist surgery tomorrow. So let's remember all those folks in prayer. Our final recharge meal was Wednesday. This last Wednesday, we will not have another till fall. But a special thank you for all those that cooked for us, all those that cleaned up, and then a very, very, very special thank you to Larry and Leah Williams for all the work they have done for us at that fellowship meal. They were there every single week, set up the meals to take to shut-ins. We appreciate everything. VBS starts in June. It's right around the corner. Taryn and Beverly have called for a meeting on May 8th, which will be a week from this Wednesday. So if you're interested, please attend that meeting. And if you don't show up, I'm sure Beverly and Taryn will give you a phone call and make sure you're at the next meeting. They really need your help. Inside your bulletin, there's a poem. It's not of Michael Joy's quality, I might add, but it's a very nice poem, and it's very fitting for today. I'd like to read it. It's called A Preacher's Heart. I think I need new bifocals is what I need. A well-spoken message stirs a heart to rejoice. There is nothing like a strong, resilient voice. But when sorrow comes, there is no better gift to impart than the gift of a caring preacher's heart. A loving touch or a kind word, a moment of counsel from God's holy word, a telephone call after you just heard is the gift of our preacher's heart. Lord, bless our preachers in each new day. Bless their ministry along the way. For fame and fortune can never impart the precious gift of a caring preacher's heart. Just a servant of Christ and at times a dear friend with a desire to love God to the very end. Tending his flock in the Savior's way is the gift of a preacher's heart. Striving to live as an apostle of Christ, serving his Father, giving godly advice, preaching and teaching and sharing the word is a gift of a caring preacher's heart. Doug and Nikki came to us 20 years ago this month from Clayton, New Mexico. They were 28 years old. Nick was a basketball coach. Douglas was a preacher of some renown. Look how things have changed in 20 years. Joan is with us. Nick's an executive at a bank. Hold it. Doug's still preaching. Oh. We appreciate those 20 years, guys. Got something special this morning, Douglas. One of your old buddies, Jason Moore. Jason, stand up with Grant and Kaylee, please. Rayleigh, I'm sorry. They're here. Thank you, guys. Jason is a preacher at Quaker Street. He was a youth minister here for many, many years, and he's one of Doug's very, very special friends. He will be bringing the lesson to us this morning. So that's an honor of you guys. Let's go to our Lord in prayer, shall we? All-powerful and loving Father, we thank you so much for this beautiful Lord's Day that you've given us. Thank you so much for the moisture that you sent our way. We appreciate that so very, very much. Be with all those that have been mentioned this morning. Be with the doctors that are tending to them. Comfort those that are hurting in all sorts of different ways, if you would, Lord. Thank you so much for the preachers and teachers of this congregation. Lord, thank you so much for this country we live in and all the freedoms we enjoy. Most importantly, Lord, thank you so much for your Son, Jesus Christ, and how much he means to us. Thank you, Lord, so much for allowing Doug and Nikki to be with us. We appreciate those 20 years so very, very, very much. We say all these things in your Lord Jesus' name. Amen.
Long walk from the back. I don't think I've ever sat in the back when I went to the church to preach. So Doug's sitting there and he hears that he's got a surprise. He's probably thinking a cruise, Reuben, to the Bahamas or something. And it's just me. 20 years. Oh my word. 20 years. You guys know what that means? David, you know what that means? That means all of you guys are getting old. I mean, look at Brian back there. He's got kids. He's an old man now. Max married. Doug's starting to look his age. You know, Doug has looked like he's in his 40s and 50s for 20 years now. So congratulations, Doug. I no longer look like your son. Doug and I went somewhere one time, and somebody thought that I was his son, which I guess would make Nikki my mother. And Joan and my brother. So now he just looks like maybe an uncle. My wife, Carrie, couldn't be here. That's unfortunate. But I brought my kids. Grant's back there in the back. When we left here, Grant was 3 years old. About like that. And running around the building, writing on all the bathroom stalls, probably, things like that. Now he is a senior in high school. He is going to Lubbock Christian in the fall. He has definitely outgrown me. When we left here, my daughter Rayleigh, who's also back there, was 6 months old. She was here. And she's now going to be a sophomore starting in the fall. And she just keeps us going all over the place, playing softball and running track and all this sort of thing. And it's really kind of fun to come back here to the place where they started. A lot of you probably don't know me and don't know them. But this was the first job or the first ministry opportunity that I had coming out of college. In 1999, Lee Rogers showed up at the bookstore that I was working at and interviewed me there. And only like Lee could. I mean, scared me to death. Sitting there in the break room, just staring a hole in me. And And, of course, several other phone calls. And I'm telling you, it was a tremendous blessing. It really was. It was a great blessing. This is a special church because a lot of the people here, first of all, but also because this was our first opportunity to do ministry, to get our feet wet. And I remember back then thinking that, you know, this is going to be really a good situation for us because we get to go to a great church that we've heard good things about. The folks that we had met were wonderful. And I get to go to this place where this new guy, Doug Austin's going to be coming, and he's only going to have been there a month before me. And so he's going to kind of get in and get a lay of the land, you know. And also, he's a grizzled veteran, you know. He was out there in Clayton, New Mexico with the ranchers, you know. And so I'm sure that guy's going to have a lot to teach me. Well, now I'm looking back, and I'm thinking, what could that punk who was younger then than I am now teach me? But I actually did. I learned a lot from Doug. I really am sad that my wife couldn't be here today. She is at a TEMSCA meet, which is just some kind of math meet down in San Antonio. But she asked me to deliver a message, which was she wishes that she could be here and see everybody except for Doug. That was her words exactly. Actually, no, she really does like Doug and Nikki quite a lot. She doesn't like a lot of people. She never really liked David very much. David and Carrie are too much alike. They would kill each other if they spent too much time. Didn't care for Tim very much either. But she doesn't like me either. So, but she does like Doug. So anyway, it's good to be here. She would really, in the spirit of Doug, I'll say my wife would kill me if she heard me say that. She really loves all these people here. I want you to know that what I want to talk about this morning is something very special to me. And I'll tell you, this church has had a part in formulating my thinking when it pertains to this particular topic. And there it is right there. I want to talk to you a little bit this morning about the church. And I've spent a lot of time talking and thinking and going to church, having been in places like Country Club Road and where I am now. At Quaker Avenue for now 12 years. I've gone to ministries and conferences, and I've been around church people. I've talked church. I grew up in the church. I've had a lot of time to think about how valuable the church is and some of the truths that you could say and talk about when it pertains to the church. Some of the things that I want to present to you are born out of the blessing that is this church. The things that I learned here. No church is perfect. This church is not perfect. The churches that I've worked at are not perfect. But each one of them have taught me something. And so this morning I'm going to kind of pass something back to you that I've learned from you. And so having said all of that, I want to get started. I wonder what would happen if you were to drive out here to Ruidoso and to make the 9 or 12 mile trek up to Ski Apache and go up on that little balcony area there right by the ski slope and just round up 20 random human beings. Or if you could go over to Washington, D.C. and walk out to the reflecting pool there, the Washington Monument, and just round up 20 random Washingtonians and visitors and tourists. Or if I could just play Jimmy Fallon for a night, and I could go out from behind my desk and go out on the streets of New York City and round up 20 random New Yorkers and ask them to fill in the blank to this question. I wonder what they would say. The question, the fill in the blank is, the church is. The church is. Clearly, if you were to go out and ask just a random drawing of people to fill in the blank, you'd get thousands of different responses, a variety of different responses. Some responses would be agreeable, and they would reflect positive views on what the church is and what the church means in the societies that they live in. Likewise, you have to know that also there'll be some very colorful fill in the blank items here that wouldn't be so complimentary of the church. Some would suggest, And they would recall that, think about it, every year in society things go terribly wrong. Whether it be a typhoon somewhere on the other side of the world, or whether it be an Ebola breakout somewhere, or whether it be a tragedy here in the United States, you can always count on the church and church people to turn out with their time, their resources, and their money. Usually when it comes to problems in society, the church is usually a part of the solution as opposed to a part of the problem. A lot of people would say that. And they would presume something like that as they filled in the blank to this statement. The church is a great civic partner. And I know it is in our community in Lubbock. We are tackling things like homelessness. We got a terrible homeless problem in Lubbock, Texas. But the churches come together and they're putting their heads together trying to come up with solutions to things like that. They tackle problems like homelessness. Or they tackle problems like hunger. They fight issues like evil, human trafficking, sex trafficking, children trafficking. Church people, churches, gather their resources and they go and they fight these kinds of indiscretions. Other people, as you well know, would not be so kind as they think about the church. It's nearly a guarantee that someone would come along and they would recount the many indiscretions of the church in history. The historical scandals, the abuses of power, the history of violence that the church has had thousands and thousands of years ago. And that person would almost certainly remind us of recent events, and they would suggest, look, these kinds of scandals, these kinds of abuses of power, they're not a thing of the past even. These kinds of things are still happening today. They wouldn't be so kind in their representation of the church. And then some people wouldn't even go out there. They would stay close to home and they would call on their own personal experiences. And they would just suggest that, you know, the church, they're hard. They're a hard lot to understand. They're a hard kind of people to get along with. Some of them are rigid. Some of them are dogmatic. Some of them are just plain mean. And then there's always the H word, which is the church is full of hypocrites. So, of course, the response, if you presented that to people, would be a mixed bag. But in all fairness, if you were to present this same kind of scenario to any kind of organization, any kind of system, like General Motors, or like Ford, or like New Mexico Military Institute, Texas Tech University, the city of Roswell, the city of Lubbock, you would get a very similar mixed kind of bag. All you have to do is go on Google. Get a Google review of Pioneer Bank. You'll have 10 glowing responses of customer service at Pioneer Bank. And then you'd have one or two cranky coots who would say something negative. That's kind of the way it is. That's kind of human nature. The problem is, as I think about the church, it's not just another organization. It's not just another system in our culture that thinks about kind of the bottom line, about the money. We can take a little bit of a PR hit. You know, it's not a very big deal. As long as we don't lose any money in the process, it's not the way the church thinks. The church is a redemptive organization. It is a life-giving organization, a selfless organization that wants to reconcile people in its communities with a loving Father. The church is, as Jesus sort of describes in John chapter 4, the church is sort of a seed that has come to life. It's like a seed that has sprouted. Jesus says to his friends in John chapter 12, he says, I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Now we give the disciples a hard time a lot of times because they could be fairly dense. But I guarantee you take any one of us and transplant us thousands of years ago and we would have been the dense ones. And I don't think the disciples had one iota, one clue of what Jesus was talking about at this moment. Jesus had started to talk about dying, and I don't think that they had a clue why he was starting to talk about dying. He had been talking about building a kingdom. How can you build a kingdom if you're going to die? But they learned soon enough after the fact that what he was saying is that even as God, even as a single living, breathing human male, he could only do so much. Now, could he have done everything? Could he have micromanaged everything, done all of the work, made all the promises, fulfilled all the promises, called all the people? Yeah, he could have done that. That's not how he chose to do it. And so they found out that it would only be in dying that the seed of faith and love and generosity, it would only be in dying that countless people, we call them the church, would rise up. After Jesus had died and gone into heaven, the church would rise up and they would assume the mission of Christ. They would go out into all parts of the world and they would begin to do what Jesus had started, which was reconciling all people to a loving Father. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German minister in the 1940s, and he said this about the church. So the church is not a religious community of worshipers of Christ. The church of Christ is Christ himself, who has taken form among the people. The church isn't just an organization that gathers once or twice a week, comes together, worships God, leaves the doors of the church, and goes out as community. It really doesn't do much. The church is a redemptive organization. The church is salt and light. It affects the community and communities that it's in. The church isn't just any other institution. Christ teaches and Paul teaches and all the disciples who have ever come behind Jesus have taught that the church is the greatest gift aside from Christ himself to the community of the world. The church is Christ in the community of the world. That's how Christ chose to do his work, to fulfill his mission. So back to my fill-in-the-blank question. What would you have people say? What would you have people say when they fill in the blank? How would you want your friends at work, or your friends at school, or your neighbors, or your family, or your friends? How would you like for them to fill that in? And I guarantee if I had each one of you just come up on stage and rattle off a few things, a few of your own fill in the blanks, we'd have 1,000 different things to say. And most of them would be true. So what I want to do here this morning is I want to present four fill-in-the-blanks, four responses that I believe are true to the core. So let's get started. Number one, the church is a reflection of Eden. The church is a reflection of Eden. I want you to consider the text from Genesis chapter 1. All the small children in here, I know, have talked and have learned about Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created all things. In the beginning, God created all things. But before he did that, in the beginning, everything was lifeless. Everything was dark. Everything was empty. Everything was void of anything organic, living. And it wasn't fun. Okay, kids, it wasn't fun. All right, you read that text there in Genesis chapter 1, and before everything comes to life, it was a boring place to be. The Genesis writer says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and empty, and darkness covered the deep waters." Dark, lifeless, empty, not fun. There's not a person in this room or this city who would ever choose to live in a world like this. I've watched episodes of Star Trek where people did live in places like this, but it wasn't because they chose it. But in the span of approximately 700 plus words here in Genesis 1 and 2, or 6 days, here's what happens. All right, here's what happens. Okay, light, evening, and morning come into being. Rain forms from bodies of water on earth, and blue skies come into view. Bodies of water take the shapes of lakes and oceans and playa lakes and rivers and waterfalls. Dry land is formed. We're starting to see some personality. Okay, Here we're starting to see some personality, some signs of living, of life. Dry land is formed, and every sort of trees, vegetation, and fruit come into being. Think about the color that would be splashed across the earth at that point when all of these things started to come into being. The sun comes into view in the daytime, and the moon and the stars, and all the celestial beings come into view during the nighttime. More personality. Nights and days and years and seasons all have their being beginning here. Fish are created. Davis, where are you? Fish. Fish come into being. Tim. Okay, fish. These guys are big fishermen. Fish are created along with every sort of marine life, like the great sea creatures and like the smaller but still just as magnificent smaller life that scurries and swarms in the water. That's how the Bible puts it there in that text, scurries and swarms. I like that. That has lots of personality. Every sort of bird, various in size, various in color, various in sound, take flight for the first time. Animals, both great and small, both mighty and meek, during that span make earth its habitat. We got tons and tons of personality that has just exploded on the scene here in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. And then, mankind. Mankind comes at this point. The crown jewel of God's work has its beginning on the sixth day of creation. Man and woman, two separate, two vastly different, you might say two different species, comes into being at that point. And though not explicitly mentioned right here in this particular text, we know what happens when mankind comes into the world. Ultimately, we get a variety of different kinds of human beings. We get all different kinds of colors of human beings. We get all different kinds of kinds. We get eccentric ones. We get short ones. Okay, we get tall ones. We get serious ones. We get smart ones. We get blue-collar ones. Hard-working ones, one species, though magnificently different and wonderful in their own right, are created at the end of the 6 days. The church is a reflection of Eden. Now, what could a guy possibly mean when he says something like that, Reuben? He might just be trying to be cute. But let me explain what I mean. Eden, as I've just described it, is anything but lifeless, dark, empty, and not fun. In the beginning, the state of what existed was lifeless and was dark and wasn't suitable for thriving life. It wasn't suitable for that abundant life that Jesus talks about later on in the New Testament. That dark, empty, not fun place, not Eden. What God created over the course of 6 days, a world full of color and personality and sound and taste and wonder and vigor, that was Eden. Eden was full of personality, and Eden was diverse. It was filled with variety. It was a place designed especially for thriving and abundant life. The church ought to be a reflection of Eden, and that it should be characterized as much by its differences as it is by its similarities. You know, and this may not seem like a very significant thing, but when you consider the world that we live in, and when you consider how institutions and systems typically respond and work, it should be a wonder to all of us. As much as people today in our society want to celebrate diversity, diversity is really not something that comes by default or that comes naturally. Most systems, businesses or schools or politics, most systems get really irritated when a part of the collective strays out and starts acting on its own. Usually what happens in that kind of system is the collective begins to rein that member back in because they don't want diversity. They want everybody to be the same. They try to bring that person back into conformity. We see it all the time. But I want you to think about this. If God expected the world, but more to the point, if God expected the church to be heterogeneous, that is, all parts being exactly the same, then why was his first act in all of creation an exercise in diversity? The church is a reflection of Eden. is made up of so many different types and kinds and colors of humans. And it's exactly how he intended it. He didn't make a mistake. And we're told that actually he was pleased with his creation. It says there in Genesis, God created all of these different things, and multiple times it's recorded that, what? It is good. And so you know what? The fact that in this very room we have young and old, that's good. That ought to be celebrated. You know what? The fact that we have blue collar and white collar in the same room, that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. That ought to be celebrated. The fact that we have rural and urban all in the same room sometimes, that ought to be celebrated. The fact that we have people from different ethnic backgrounds, different colors, there's nothing wrong with that. That's the way the church ought to be. We should not be concerned about that. Because God said it was good. Number two. The church is a refuge of hope. The church is a refuge of hope. The term refuge suggests that people are fleeing away from danger, something that has threatened them in the past. Specifically, refuge presumes that people are fleeing backwards, away from something that may in the past have hurt them. For example, the South Sudanese people, for many years now, have been fleeing south into the northern parts of Uganda. Why? Because there are rebels that have been making life very difficult for them. And so what are they doing there? Of course, they're fleeing away from the danger into northern Uganda, where they're now getting cared for by the Ugandan people and the Ugandan government. The church, likewise, is a refuge for people who have been hurt or people who are at risk of being hurt. You know, that's pretty much all of us. Mark chapter 6, we read this story, a very well-known story where Jesus takes five pieces of bread, two small fish. He prays over them and he feeds hungry people. Verse 32. So they left by boat for a quiet place where they could be alone. But many people recognized them and they saw them leaving. And people from many towns ran ahead along the shore. And they got there ahead of them. Jesus saw the huge crowd as he stepped from the boat. And Jesus had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Now, I'll admit here that what we don't see here are church people per se. This is really a story about people in general. A large group of people in this particular context. And I think that you'll agree with me. That while different groups of people look differently, this particular group was probably a little less wealthy, probably a little bit more ordinary. That fundamentally, whether you're here or you're here or you're here or you're here, that fundamentally people are people, especially deep down in their spirit. People get all twisted up inside. People have all kinds of issues that they have to deal with during their lifetime that causes them to struggle and wrestle and get wounded and get hurt. People get all twisted up inside. And it's common for even the most well-adjusted people over time to carry more and more baggage from their past, from their own personal mistakes to their own personal insecurities, their deficiencies, or things that have happened to them that they had no clue were going to happen. When Jesus left the boat, I really believe that's what he saw when he looked out across the crowd of people. He saw people out there who were looking for hope. Why? Of course they were. They ran all the way around the lake to get to him because they were looking for something substantive, something better than what they'd had up to that point. And what the disciples likely saw in this context was an invasion of their privacy. Disciples were looking forward to a getaway. They were looking forward to some R&R, some rest and relaxation, you know. And you can imagine that when they got across the other side and they saw the crowds of people, just how their spirit probably, oh my goodness, we cannot get away from these folks. What Jesus likely saw well beyond the exterior of the people was brokenness and hurt and emptiness. And so, without one thought for his own condition, without one thought for his own fatigue, I mean, he was going across for rest and relaxation also. Without one thought for his recent loss, this is right in the heels of losing John the Baptist, his cousin. Jesus jumps out of that boat and he gives those people all that he can give them. He pours himself into them all day long. And I'm just envisioning in my mind Jesus walking around the crowds and shaking hands and hugging babies and hugging, you know, ladies and people bringing the sick. And he just pours himself into these people physically. And then he speaks words of truth and life and encouragement. And then you know what? On top of all that, at the end of the day, he gives them a little something to eat. It's no secret that the reason people were so attracted to Jesus was because he offered them something different than the other religious leaders were offering them. He was offering them something real and genuine and authentic. He was giving them something to hope for. And you know as well as I do that you got to have something to hope for, something to look forward to. And Jesus gave them that. The church is a refuge of hope like Jesus was. A place where broken people are welcome. A place where they are invited to come in. A place where they can go in and be nurtured, to be fed, to receive healing from old wounds. Church is not a place where people come, at least those kinds of people come, to be judged or to be condemned. There are other places in the world where you can go get judged and condemned. Now, is there a time for judgment? Yeah, there's a time for judgment. Maybe a brother or sister among us needs some kind of discipline. But the people in that crowd, this was not a time for judgment or condemnation. This was a time for engagement. Number three, the church is the eyes of Jesus. The church is the eyes of Jesus. The heading of my NIV Bible here says that the following section is Jesus anointed by a sinful woman. And I kind of have a feeling that Jesus may not have approved of that heading because it seems just a little bit disparaging of this lady. And I don't see Jesus as the disparaging type. But Luke writes here in verse 37 and following, when a certain immoral woman from the city heard Jesus was eating there, she brought a beautiful alabaster jar filled with expensive perfume. And then she knelt behind him at his feet. She wiped them off with her hair, and she kept kissing his feet and putting perfume on them. And when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this guy was a prophet, he would know the kind of woman who is touching him. And she's a sinner. We don't have a whole lot of information as it pertains to this woman here at hand, except, you know, what we can assume about her from the worldview of the people at that time or from the context here. And based on the worldview of the people at that time, I think we can conclude pretty confidently that as it pertains to the people looking on, her actions were completely out of the norm. They were not socially acceptable at the time. This was a woman among men. It was a woman really in a man's world who had come in and then who made a spectacle out of herself. She let her hair down among the crowd of men, which I think back then was probably socially taboo. And then she began to caress Jesus' feet with her hair. That's awkward. It was almost... And what we think we know about this woman is that she was probably, it says she was a sinner, so I think most scholars will say she was a prostitute. She brings a very expensive jar of perfume, so she probably had a lucrative business. A casual reading of the story, and you can't hardly blame Simon. You can't hardly blame the other people in attendance for being upset. The woman really was out of line. She was being inappropriate. It was completely taboo. And her exploits as a woman of the night preceded her. She was a sinner. That's what the people there saw. Every single person that was there that day, that's what they saw. But that's not what Jesus saw. Just as when Jesus looks at you, that's not the first thing that he sees.
That was not what Jesus saw. Jesus saw a woman, more specifically, Jesus saw a human being who had been dealt a very difficult hand in life. We don't know exactly what her hand looked like. We don't know what had brought her to this point, whether it had been a bad family upbringing or whether it had been a husband who had kicked her out and the only thing that she knew to do to make money and survive was to prostitute herself in the town. What Jesus saw was a woman who had experienced loss, was hurting, and quite honestly was probably doing about the only thing that she knew to do, not to die. Right or wrong. The Pharisees saw an immoral sinner. Jesus saw a human being who was created in His image, who had been ravaged by sin and pain. And to Jesus, that was much more offensive than any previous deviant behavior that she had committed to that point. That is not what He created human beings for. He did not create them to come in the world and to be hurt. He created them for abundant living. The church is the eyes of Jesus. Like the church, or like Jesus, the church sees beyond the individual's exterior, well beyond the surface of someone's facade. And the church sees that person's deeper condition, and the church hurts with them. And with that vision, the offensive stuff and the messiness, that stuff all fades into the background. And the hurt and the fundamental needs of that person, that's what becomes meaningful to us in the church. That comes to the foreground. That's what we want to address. And as such, the church is merciful before it is judgmental. As such, the church is graceful before it is condemning. And you know what? The church doesn't hesitate, like Jesus didn't hesitate, to get down and get His hands dirty. Church is okay with that. You got to be a little bit messy, or at least be willing to get a little bit messy to engage people not in this room, and even in this room. The church is the eyes of Jesus. The church sees people the way that Jesus sees people. And finally, number four, the church is a glimpse of the prophetic. The church is a glimpse of the prophetic. In Isaiah chapter 11, the prophet sets out to paint a new portrait for the people of Israel at that time of what the king would look like in the future. They knew what their king looked like. The best king that they ever had was David. And this guy would come from David. And David was the most renowned king in all of Israel. He is the one who brought the most glory and the most splendor to the nation. But even the king that Isaiah talks about here would be somewhat different than David himself. So Isaiah writes this: "In that day the wolf and the lamb will live together. The leopard will lie down with the baby goat. The calf and the yearling will be safe with the lion. And a little child will lead them. The cow will graze near the bear. The cub and the calf will lie down together. The lion will eat hay like a cow. The baby will play safely near the hole of a cobra. Yes, a little child will put its hand in a nest of deadly snakes without harm. Nothing will hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for as the waters fill the sea, so the earth will be filled with people who knows the Lord." Put bluntly, people who know the Lord live together in unity. People who know the Lord find a way to peace. In spite of their differences, physically, socially, in spite of their histories of origin, in spite of even sometimes of their different understandings of biblical tradition or biblical interpretation, people of God, they live in unity because what unites them is stronger than those things out there or even among them that often seeks to divide them. The church is a glimpse of the prophetic in that sense. It includes various kinds of people in other contexts would, as Isaiah suggests here in 11, would devour each other.
If it wasn't for the Spirit of Christ in this place, I think what Isaiah is saying is you guys would, at some point, would start to just devour one another. There would be hate and discord among you. But because of the Spirit of Christ among them, with love being the primary virtue, because God is love, they function as the body of Christ in the world. They function as a testimony of Jesus' power and goodness. And as such, they provide a testimony of what Christ is able to do in the world, and that is reconcile all people to a loving Father. If you can bring all these diverse kinds of people together, all these histories of origin, if you can do all that, if you can bring two people together who are a lot alike, then that suggests to people out in our society that's somebody to put my faith in. That is somebody who's powerful enough to put my faith in. A church like this, unified in the core truths of Jesus' teaching, will go out into its communities. They'll go 4,000 miles south to Argentina or Brazil, or they go 8,000 miles across the ocean to Uganda or Kenya. They'll go to places unknown, and they'll present the gospel. And guess what? Guess what will happen when a church like this goes out into its community and out into the world? Those people out there, they'll listen to you, because the church is a portrait of the prophetic. Because those people, in spite of all the odds against them for getting along and having unity, those people listen to you, because the power of Christ is so evident in your unity. When people so diverse and different demonstrate that they can live together in unity, not just live together, but they can thrive together, they are a testimony of the power of the God that makes it so. That is a God who is worthy of our faith. And so this morning, as we conclude, you know, we can't control what people have come to believe about the church, what they might say about the church on the basis of their experiences, what they've read in history books. But you know what we can do? We can promote among people in our world, in our communities, in our society, a more biblical vision of the church here in the year 2019, of what the church really is. And the church is really society's gift from Christ to reconcile all people to a loving Father. That's some of the stuff that I've learned from churches like this. And so with that said, I want to thank you. I'm kind of a sentimental guy. And that said, those are some words and some sentiments that I've learned from this church. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. This is a special time for the church and for Doug and Nikki. And this is a really special congregation. And it's been an honor to be here with you this morning. And I know at this time, the leaders of the church like to extend an invitation. So if you're here this morning and you have a need, you need prayers from the church, or you need to share something that's on your heart, your heart's broken, I know the folks here would like to wrap their arms around you and love you back up, I guess like they say back in Texas, love you back up. So whatever your need is, if you'd like to put Christ on in baptism, I know we're always glad to do that. So whatever your need might be, why don't you stand with me and let's sing.